Well, thank you very much for giving me the chance to talk here to two such interesting groups of scientists. I want to try to connect the topics of the two workshops that are going on right now, and this will allow me to give a talk which is vaguely based on four papers which I was involved in, two more on the TI side with the Stanford group, and two more on holography, with Carlos and Chris-san, and one with Joseph and Tadashi. And so what I tried to outline here before you all came into the room was that at first it sounds like a rather strange proposal that we somehow want to connect those two topics. And if you think about what holography is a great tool because it gives us these solvable toy models of strong coupling dynamics. We can study strongly coupled series for which we otherwise have no analytic control, at least if you want to study dynamical things. And somehow we want to apply holography to topological insulators, which on the other hand are all about non-interacting electron systems, at least the ones that have been observed in nature. And this was, of course, a great story where theorists predicted and then experimentalists found these novel topological phases of non-interacting electron systems. So clearly we need to do something in order to force a connection between those. We have our one sledgehammer in ABS-CFT, which is the one tool we want to apply to condensed matter physics. If the problem at hand doesn't allow us to use the tool we want, we need to change the problem a little bit so it becomes more interesting to us. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about fractional topological insulators, which should be a novel phase of a strongly interacting electron system. And the one price we have to pay, which is not that unusual for string theories, we are no longer talking about predicted and observed, but we're talking about theoretical speculations. But no, that's a good thing to do. Yeah. I mean, this was really a very powerful theory. People understood enough about this that they could switch on a computer and tell you this is a topological insulator if you look, and then people looked and it's right. Like so in order to get there, I wanted to first give you a very brief way, show you how I think about topological insulators, a particle physicist's view on topological insulators. On the ordinary ones, the non-interacting free ones, so we can talk about the fractional ones, and then we can ask ourselves, what can holography do for us? So what I want to end up with at this first half of my talk, I want to show you, a picture of fractional topological insulators, and I want to identify four interesting strong coupling problems which you would like to address, and I tell you which one of those strong coupling problems we can address with holography. There will be some which I think holography is good for, some which holography is clearly not good for. Some of this has been done, some of this needs to be done. So hopefully I'll end up with having everybody excited about trying to do some holographic calculations about topological insulators. So the way particle physicists always organize their thinking is by energy scale. So we're going to end up somewhere over here in IR, and I'm going to start with the UV. So what a topological insulator is all about in UV, so we have non-interacting electrons. I don't want to say free because they are in a periodic potential. Condensed matter physics 101. Then you know what this is all about. It's all about bands, right? You have some various bands. You have some E of K. And the important thing for an insulator is there's some gap. And down here, everything's filled. Up there, everything's empty. And now here comes the claim. The claim is that the topology of these bands is robust. So it means the topology of the bands doesn't change if you wiggle around or deform your system, perturb it, put in dirt in such a way that you do not close the gap. You can move around these bands in some random ways, make they're even spatially dependent. But the topology of those bands should be robust. And so if you can define some topological quantum numbers associated to this band structure, that shouldn't change under deformations that leave the gap untouched. And the prime example, the old example for this that is always based on, is this TKNN theory of the quantum Hall effect, where they identified some sort of connection, right? You can define a connection for your band structure with the sum of all the occupied bands. And you ask yourself, how does a band change as you move around them? How does a state change as you move around the brilliant zone? So you want to know how does the wave function of the state change as you change the momentum. That defines for you something like a gauge field, a connection you define on the bands, and then you can calculate the integral of that. You can associate the field strength with the band, and this integral gives you some integer. Right? It's like a flux of a gauge field, and that gives you an integer, and that explains to you why the quantum Hall effect, the free quantum Hall effect, the ordinary quantum Hall effect, why this gave you integer plateaus with such high precision, despite dirt, despite everything, you had perfect integers. And that's a serious way of understanding this. And this was generalized for the topological insulator by people in the room, where they identified that you can similar, if you look at the some sort of non-abelian connection where you have some AI alpha beta, I have some alpha occupied, BKI beta occupied, you can, from this you can obtain a C2 value, it's topologically invariant. And in particular for the 3D topological insulator, that C2 topological invariant tells you whether you're in a, now I have a trivial or topological non-trivial topological insulator. So you, first of all, you realize there are two classes. Before that work, people didn't even know that. So if you have a band insulator, there's in 3+1 dimensions, you have this option of having the C2 valued invariant either being 1 or minus 1, or 0 and 1, depending how one accounts. And this recipe comes with a very detailed prescription of, you know, for a given material, if you're strong enough to calculate the band structure, you can calculate the topological invariant and find out whether that particular material should be trivial or non-trivial topologically. So this is all a very beautiful story, but that's too complicated for a particle physicist. Right? The last time we've seen band structures were when we undergraduated. The first thing which we do is we integrate out all by one band. Right, so when I do this, what I end up with, I end up with a picture where I have a filled band, I have an empty band, and all I want to keep is basically the bottom part of this. I'm going to get a spectrum where E goes as P squared. And now I can write down an effective Lagrangian for a fixed picture like this. And the effective Lagrangian I have here is psi bar T slash psi plus M psi bar psi. So we're claiming in the end the whole structure of this topological insulator over here. If I look at the dynamics of this system, it should all be about the degrees of freedom that are sitting close to the band. Those are the lowest energy excitations above the gap I can have. So if I ask myself what's happening if I excite things above the gap, the first thing I do is I take the last filled band and excite it to the first unfilled band. And this is the effective Lagrangian I can write down for the system. It's just a free Dirac equation. So let's first see that this is strong enough to still capture all the physics which we had over there, right? So if I look at this low energy effective action, the only parameter I have in the game is the mass. The mass is the one parameter my low energy effective action has. I should get that mass by some sort of matching calculation, some correlation function I want to calculate and compare to the UV theory, which is this microscopic Hamiltonian of electrons in the free band structure. So first you should know that 3+1 dimensions in general, this mass is a complex number. And the reason for this is because I have psi bar psi and then have psi bar gamma phi psi. So I could write down two terms in my Lagrangian, but the way it's typically done is you write down a complex parameter m, understanding that the real part of m is the standard mass and the imaginary part of m is the axial mass. In order to make the theory more interesting, what you want to impose is you want to impose time reversal invariance, because time reversal basically takes the mass into its complex conjugate. You see that if I have time reversal invariant system, the mass can be real. And the moment you have the mass real and non-zero, you see there are two options. The mass can be positive, for the Marcion is negative. And the claim is this is one of them. Now, by convention, we can take this to be the topologically trivial material, and then this would be the non-trivial material.
There is an actually single direct model.
I mean, three plus one dimension side, there's no entrance side. There are similar stories you can do in two plus one dimensions, but then I would start with an even number of them. Yeah. So what did I want to say? Okay, so now we gained something. We have a very simple system. That simple system is still rich enough to characterize our two allowed phases. So the low energy effective theory at this level knows that, you know, in this time reversing invariant system, I have a C2 classification. We have a positive or a negative mass option. Of course, what I lost in this whole procedure is the ability to calculate for a specific material. Right over there, you have a recipe for a given material. You know whether this integer is, you know, plus one or minus one. Over here, I just tell you I have a low energy effective theory which describes last occupied and first empty band. And that low energy effective theory is rich enough to know that there's a C2 classification of allowed models, but it can no longer tell you for a given material where you know the microscopic Hamiltonian is this mass going to be positive or negative. That's something. In order to figure that out, we'd have to go back to the UV. That's something important to keep in mind, because the rest of my talk will mostly be at that level, because that's the language I understand. And therefore, I will not be able to make any predictions about any models, as I admitted in the very beginning, and let me get a paper.
Well, actually, let me comment. In reality, the way discovery was actually made, it was based on this kind of reasoning. Because there's a parameter you can tune to change mass from positive to negative.
So you knew that, yeah, and that's how you discovered that? Yeah. But you could do that. Thank you.
And the real material, like this selenite, is actually very close to this.
So this is better than I made it sound like. Thank you. So there's one more step. Let's talk a little bit about consequences of this before I integrate out more. The most interesting consequence of having the mass either being positive or negative is that you can build interfaces where at the interface you can have the mass being bigger on one side and less on the other side. For example, you could have vacuum on one side, or no, any material of the sort that people studied for the last few hundred years, and you have one of those new ones over here. And then since the mass has to cross, I'm not drawing this better. So if I draw the mass has to cross zero at the interface. That gives me a localized zero mode. It's guaranteed to give me a localized zero mode. It's actually something particle physicists knew a long time ago. In continuum, it's been done by Cullen and Harvey, and on the lattice was David Kaplan who first discovered this. It's called this is how people do lattice fermions these days. They do this all one dimension higher and 4 plus 1 dimensions. If you have a domain one, you localize the 3 plus 1 dimension chiral fermion in the interface. And it's well known. If I have a real mass that crosses zero, you're guaranteed to get a localized zero mode on the interface, at least one or some odd number. Okay. To make the story even more easy to grasp, to see its consequences, we can go one more step into the IR and integrate out the last fermion. So when can I do this? So naively you would think what happens here is that the energy, in order for me to be allowed to integrate out the last fermions, I want to study these energies that are below the gap. But if I study the interface, that isn't really good enough because of this, right? If I want to describe the bulk material, I'm fine. All I need to make sure is if I have energies that are below the gap, I can't excite this last fermion because this is still here the gap. I can't excite the last fermion, I can integrate it out, write down a low energy degrees of effective theory for whatever is left. We're going to talk about this in a second. But if I do study interfaces, which really where all the money is, then you have to worry about I have a massless degree of freedom on the interface. I shouldn't write down a low energy degrees, low energy effective theory just because I'm below the gap, because I have to somehow include this massless mode. So what I can do, this massless mode is guaranteed to be massless, as long as I restrict the time reversal invariant system. What I can do is I can add a time reversal breaking external perturbation in a study, E being less than E external. So if you want to describe interfaces using the effective theorem I'm about to write down, you have to be careful that this effective theorem is only valid if you actually break time reversal invariants and gap that surface mode together with the bulk modes. Otherwise, you can't use the last effective theory. And that's important to keep in mind. You have, this is easy to achieve experimentally by, say, studying a system in external electric field. And then what do you get? You get a new effective theory. Let me call it an effective tilde. What are the degrees of freedom that are left after I integrated out my fermions? Well, there's nothing left in my material, but I still have external electric and magnetic fields. So I could put it on, you know, curved backgrounds, like Son told us at the beginning of this workshop. But for now, let me restrict on models that are studied in flat spatial geometry, but in some background electromagnetic fields. That's what you actually measure and what you're interested in, some transport properties. So the degrees of freedom that you're allowed to write down are basically just the electric and the magnetic field by rotation invariance. The only terms which involve two derivatives are d squared and the b squared term. And now you introduce these material constants epsilon and mu because there's some effective theory. Those don't have to be vacuum anymore. But there's one more term you can add, which is a zeta g dot b term with some appropriate pi's. It depends on what convention you want to use, but so you have to ask yourself, how can this possibly be time reversal invariant? Under t, the zeta term goes into minus itself. But you should be aware that if you study your system on a Euclidean four manifold, or if you study vacuum to vacuum transition amplitudes that include flux insertions, the zeta has a periodicity. Zeta goes to zeta plus 2 pi. And therefore, you see that zeta equals pi or zero are both time reversal invariants. So this very low energy effective action is still strong enough to recognize that there's a C2 classification. It has the zeta parameter. The zeta parameter can take one out of two values. And in this case, my claim is I can make actually the connection precise. So here's the masses, either positive or negative. Here, zeta is equal to zero pi. And what you want to mass is zeta equals zero corresponds to the positive mass, zeta equals pi corresponds to the negative mass. Let me illustrate this to you how one can do this integrating out. And that you can do by an anomaly argument. And that will tell us how robust this argument is in the end. So if you look at the system, that if this system were massless, if my Lagrangian has no mass term in there, I have a chiral symmetry. I can rotate my left components, my right components independently, or in other words, I can send psi to the E, I, gamma, phi, alpha, psi. Okay. So this is a symmetry. This is a symmetry at non-zero mass. If you treat your mass as a spurion, at least that's how I would call it. Which just means I make my mass transform under this transformation as well. But the mass term violates chiral symmetry, but you can always make the mass term invariant by saying the mass transforms under the symmetry as well. The word spurion implies that the way you achieve this, you couple it to a background scalar field, you give the scalar field the expectation value, and that's what the mass term is, and then at the end you decouple the scalar field again. That just gives you motivation of why you should treat parameters in your Lagrangian as transforming under a symmetry. But you should know what this allows you. This allows you to always pick the mass to be real and positive. Right, so this symmetry seems to tell you can always take your mass, even though I told you there's a C2 classification over here, which says my mass can be negative or positive. I seem to have a symmetry in my problem which allows me to take the mass and always rotate it back to positive and real. So how can there be C2 classification? The problem is that this symmetry isn't just broken by the mass, but it's also anomalous. And if you ask yourself what happens to the series anomalous under a U1 transformation, the measure in the path integral isn't invariant. It actually transforms and transforms in such a way that it spits out an L effective, which is given by a zeta which has equal to pi times some group theory factor. This group theory factor just comes from the triangle diagram. And you can write out the C as being the sum over all the fields that can run in the loop.
times the charge of the fields cleared in units of E. And for an electron, I have one field of charge 1 that gives me equal to 1. And what I know is squished up here in the corner of the blackboard, that's going to be the most important formula if you want to talk about how this generalizes to fractions of top-level insulators. Because once you have that formula, you can easily ask what happens if you have any different matter content. All I need to do in order to integrate out a bunch of massive fermions that couple to an external electromagnetic field, ask myself what sort of state it generates. I need to sum up all the fields and take their charge square. Yes, go ahead.
This reactor, maybe you said, maybe I lost this one point that you cared about here diverse and invariant only because you are also thinking about systems which don't have a boundary or manifold. Is that like, because earlier, once you have, you said you are breaking diverse and then you are considering what happens. But again, you said that under time reversal, I mean, you want E dot B to be time reversal only when you're putting on a system and it doesn't have a boundary. And then only in that case, theta has a periodicity. So that's the consistency you're saying?
Yeah, you can study one in the same system either as a bulk material, as a gap material. In a bulk or boundary material, I think you have a very strong argument that this needs to be true. The gap material is the same theory, right? This is the effective theory, it's still going to be the effective theory, but the only question is when does the effective theory hold? If I have a bulk material, it would hold at all energy scales below the gap. If I have a boundary material, I need to make sure that the energies I study are actually less than, not the gap, but less than this external perturbation.
Yeah, but that was breaking time for symmetry.
Yeah, it is.
So then only break time reversal symmetry on the surface.
So.
Yeah, but then it tells you about the bulk. Theta equals to pi is a bulk
property. So if you look at how this looks like in practice, now this sounds all pretty abstract, but you can make some very firm predictions based on this effective theory. And I wasn't going to talk about this, but since there are questions. So you can study this law in an effective theory, right? Does electrodynamics, as a theta term, you can ask yourself, does this look different from electrodynamics as you know it? It looks very different. It has some really funky properties. Gives you magnetic mirror charges, it gives you Kerr effects, it gives you Faraday effects, it gives you all sorts of things which you wouldn't have without a theta term. So if I look at any one of these experimental consequences, for example, the Kerr angle, which we get by, the polarization of light will get changed if I deflect off.
Did you have surface color?
Yes. But so you would get a picture. You get a picture where to calculate this as a theta equal to pi, I would get, if I plot the Kerr angle as a function of some external magnetic field, for example. No, it could deposit a surface layer of something magnetic on top of your TI. Then if I plug in theta equals pi or theta equals minus pi, I do get different answers. The Kerr angle goes one way or the other. So you could ask yourself, how could this possibly time reverse an invariant? Well, it's not because you added this perturbation. It's more like an explicit versus spontaneous symmetry. You can get a picture like if you measure this current angle as a function of external perturbation, you should get, if time reverse an invariant is explicitly broken, I follow a path which will eventually lead me to the theta equals pi theory, because in this regime over here, my low energy effective theory in terms of the theta equals to pi is a good low energy effective theory. Then once my P becomes too small, I should stop using my low energy effective theory. I know at the point where time reversal invariance is exactly zero, time reversal symmetry is exact, there shouldn't be any effect. Then I go over here, and then I know over here I again get the linear behavior. I know when I have a strong external B field. So by extrapolating, if you measure this, which nobody has, but if somebody were to measure this, you should be able to find the theta equals pi and the theta equals minus pi. Values is predicted by the non-energy effective theory by extrapolating the measurement by measuring the current angle as a function of B. Even so, it's strictly B to zero, and you shouldn't lose this non-energy effective theory anymore.
But if you put your system on a T-tree, you can't embed T-tree, I agree, in R3, but suppose I put it in some way, then, and you don't allow any time to breaking by any kind.
Well, if you study on T3, then you don't have to worry about anything, right? Then the energies below the gap, that's the right low energy effective theory.
Okay, that's
right. If it's As a bulk material, that stuff isn't that interesting, right? Most of its interesting properties come from the surface. So for the surface, you have to do constructions like this. But because, and you can also just use this picture, right? There's nothing wrong with this picture. It's just, no, if you want to use this language, you have to make sure you're in a regime where it applies. No, this one is stronger. If you want to describe the surfaces, and for example, you want to explicitly see the surface modes, you might as well stick with massive Dirac fermions coupled to gauge fields. No, that's the sort of system we all love. And, this one would be even better, but this one is too hard for me, but this one I can see. The main reason I talked about all of this is now you can, we want to generalize this to a fraction topological insulator, right? So we want to include strong interactions, E minus interactions, and see how this picture gets modified. And we model this on the transition from when people understood the quantum Hall effect and they went to the fraction quantum Hall effect. There are many theoretical different ways to use of theoretical language to describe this, but one way to describe what happens when you go from the quantum Hall effect to the fraction quantum Hall effect, maybe the most exotic one, but something that resonates well with particle physicists, to say what's happening over here, I have my electron, which is in some fraction, in some quantum Hall state, and what happens is I go over to the fraction quantum Hall state, this electron fractionalizes into partons, so that's a parton picture of the fraction quantum Hall effect. And each parton is just an ordinary quantum Hall effect, quantum Hall state. That way you automatically get a fraction quantum Hall state. So we can do the same here. If I just demand from the fraction pi, the basic picture is I demand that the electron E minus splits up into three partons, or n partons of charge E minus over n.
What do you mean by the little circle you drew around those?
What I mean by this, okay, I'll come to this in a second. So let me first do a thing that's easy to do. By the moment I said my electron broke up into n partons of charge E over n, I can just calculate the theta here is equal to pi times c, and the c is now given by, again, the sum over all fields. I do the same triangle diagram, sum over all fields, charge of the field. Squared, and I have n fields, so the sum gives me an n, but each field has a charge 1 over n squared, so I get 1 over n.
So how do you distribute spin to every part?
I didn't care right now, but if this is a relativistic theory, then each one of those partons would have spin a half. So if you But in a condensed matter system where spin may or may not be a conserved quantum number, I really don't care about this, about what spin is.
Yeah, but you have to make sure that n parton together will still be a scalar
half. So this is right now, I just told you, the moment you broke up the electron into n partons, you always get theta equals pi over n. There are various ways of achieving this, which is what I'm going to talk about next. And in some of them, you can even in the relativistic setting ensure that what you get out as an electron has spin a half. The most naive one, in the relativistic setting, you get electrons which wouldn't be spin a half. But again, in a condensed matter system, it's not necessarily clear you need to care about the spin quantum number. It may be a good quantum number, maybe not. No, that may be something you don't want to get out of this Lorentz effective theory. But even in the relativistic case, I can give you models where the electron has spin a half. But now ask me the same question again in 5 minutes, and then hopefully we'll come clear. So now I first need to answer John's question, which is the next in my agenda. Now what did I mean by this little ball around those partons? So what do I want of my partons? Right? So clearly in our world, we don't have electrons that are tend to break up all the time into three partons. You never see those three partons. So what on earth am I talking about? So what I need, in addition to my partons, is that I need some sort of statistical gauge field. And the purpose of this statistical gauge fields is twofold. What I want is, for one, I want them to ensure Gauss's law, which is I take the mean at the next charge of the material of a piece of non-fractional topological insulator gonna be integer. That some chunk of that material, some wafer or something, somebody managed to grow a material that has this properties. You don't want in the end predict that material as an electron charge of a certain net charge. So what I want to allow is I have a chunk of this material, the electron should be able to break up, and you know, there should be, the particles can wander around and can be anywhere in this chunk of material. They really can, you know, separate from each other inside this material. I want to ensure that there's some law, some Gauss's law, which tells me that the net charge of the whole chunk always going to be an integer. So there can never be an odd, you know, an odd fraction of three of these particles around. They always need to be three. They don't need to be on top of each other. They can be as far separated as you want. Inside the material, the net charge is going to be equal to three. Also, what I want is that outside the material, right, in the world as we know it, since we don't live inside a fraction topological insulator, the statistical gauge fields should confine and ensure that basically my, you know, partners always form electrons. Right. So inside the topological insulator, I want them to be deconfined, to be allowed to wander around. Outside the material, my electrons have to be electrons, not partners. So that's the two roles the statistical gauge fields are supposed to have. But even demanding this, I still have three options. Three broad classes of options. Let me introduce those three and then I'll tell you some of their properties. So we can have, the easiest maybe example is to have three abelian gauge fields. The simplest example of maybe writing something in this class would be if you have n equals 3, 3 partons, all you need, you would have a U1 squared series that's completely sufficient. You can write on 2 U1s, which ensure that the only gauge in that combination of partons you can write down gives me an electron. What I can also do is I can write down a non-abelian statistical gauge field, in which case it's strongly interacting, typically, well, potentially, no, it's certainly interacting. And the easiest example here would be SU3 for n equals 3. Well, you might jump at me, apparently are not, but no, SU3 gauge fields typically are confining, right? With one flavor, QCD with one flavor would be a confining series. So when I want to write on SU3 gauge fields, what I need to do in addition, I need to add some extra matter, for example, extra adjoint matter, which ensures that my theory is inside what we would call the conformal window. So I have a truly deconfined theory.
So unlike fraction quantum functions, these are compressible states.
Let me talk about this in a second. These two would be the third option which I'm about to write down. You can also go to a Higgs space. One way to go from this SU3 to this U1 squared would be this is the maximal abelian subgroup of this SU3. So you can go from here to here by some sort of Higgs mechanism where you give a VEF to some of this extrascalar matter. You would naturally go from here to there. But this is really a simplified version of this. The third phase which you could be in is some Higgs phase. May I completely break down my U1s. And all I'm left with is a C3 gauge symmetry. That's enough to ensure that the only gauge invariant combination of my partons is carries integer electron charge. So now all three of those, now by this calculation, when I calculate zeta for you, all I care is that the relevant degrees of freedom are these partons. I can write on my anomaly triangle diagram what runs around in the anomaly are partons. I don't give a damn about what the statistical gauge fields are doing. What the statistical gauge fields are doing is completely irrelevant for calculating zeta. But the statistical gauge fields, of course, do play a role. And there's a different topological property that these statistical gauge fields do determine. Right? So while zeta equals 1 over n or pi over n is insensitive, to the nature of the statistical gauge fields, Something else is maybe the ground state dependency. This is a different topological property you could measure in the system. No, you could study in the system on a piece of paper. It's also a topological property, and this is a topological property that depends sensitively on how I exactly achieve this fractional topological insulator. So one topological property, the Seder, is insensitive to the details, only depends on the number of patterns. The other property, the ground state degeneracy, depends in detail on those, which one of those three models you're looking at. And in particular, you should note that, this now comes to your question of whether these are compressible or not, that the first, so if I call this ABC, A and B are gaps. That's not, we'll speak to the ground state degeneracy in a second. Gapless, sorry, I said exactly the right C is gap. So if I, let me erase some of my pretty picture, I'm going to come back. We're not never going to talk about the UV part of this picture anymore, so I can make space of it. Since this is exactly what I don't have, right? I don't have a good UV distance of this. Actions of logic. Everything is deconfined, right? This is three deconfined gauge fields, non-abelian deconfined gauge fields, or a Higgs phase measure.
With extra matter.
That's why I needed the extra matter.
You're going to talk about insulator phase, so every part is gas.
You mean the first
case,
not
a so my models A and B are field. No, these two options, A and B, I ensure that my statistical gauge fields are gapless, so I'm in deconfined phase. So I have gapless modes around. Let me talk about this. All gapless modes are electrically neutral in this case. So in case A and B, what? That's the electron. No, there I cited electrons too. The other fields which have the same quantum number as the electron. That shouldn't bother you, right? In band insulator, you have also more than one electron. Because the three, we can't think of them as being different particles. But yes, I would get more. I will not get any particle which doesn't have. It has like the fractional quantum numbers. The only charged particles I get have the quantum number of electrons, but there will be more quantum numbers of the electrons. So this is, these two realizations, they would be compressible in the sense that they have massless, gapless modes around, but these are all electrically neutral. They're more like phonons. You're never bothered by an insulator having light phonons around. These do not contribute to charge transport. These would still be insulators. All charged matter is gap. The only gapless matter is neutral. Higgs realization is completely gapped to begin with. There's nothing massless around. And this distinguishing feature is also very important for the ground state degeneracy because of this MIT theorem. So John and others, probably all of the judges on it. So there's an MIT, what the people at MIT prove is that if I have no gap, if I have a gap and I have Zeta being fractional, those two together imply that I have to have a ground state degeneracy on TC. So we know that phase C needs to have a ground state, non-trivial ground state on the three torus, but A and B avoid that theorem by being gapless. They don't have to have a non-trivial ground state degeneracy on T3. Then you can make a table. You can look at model A, you can look at model B, you can look at model C. You can ask yourself, what is the ground state degeneracy on the T3? And then for model A, which was the abelian gauge fields, you have no degeneracy, unique. The ground state on G3 is unique. For model C, it's basically N cube degenerate. That's very easy to understand. You have a CN gauge symmetry. You have discrete Wilson lines associated to the CN around all three of the cycles of the T3. That gives me N cube different back here. And in here, typically in the non-abelian, I'm in a deconfined non-abelian theory. By the MIT theorem, it wouldn't have to be degenerate, but typically it is. Because what typically happens if you have a non-abelian gauge symmetry, if you're in the deconfined phase, you get a CN, spontaneous CN breaking. That's what happens if you start a QCD at finite temperatures. There's a CN center symmetry that spontaneously breaks, and from that you again get this N cubed ground state degeneracy. But if you study it, my favorite example of non-abelian gauge symmetry with extra adjoint matter that rises into the conformal window, N equals 4 Supermills, which is the one which we're going to soon use, then you actually wouldn't write that N equals 4 Supermills in the deconfined phase actually has a modelized space for the Wilson loop around the surface. So you don't have to be in the spontaneously broken, in the phase where the N is spontaneously broken. You have a whole modelized space, and the analysis of the ground state degeneracy becomes more complicated. So to some extent, this is the most complicated case to look at if you want to study ground state degeneracy. Typically, I would also get an N cubed here, but you know, N equals 4 Supermills may be the one laudable exception where you may or may not have an N cubed ground state degeneracy, but you don't have to. Here you have to. Here you clearly don't. No, abelian gauge fields on a T3 have a unique ground state. Here you may or may not have a ground state difference.
So if you do get the abelian gauge theory by Maxwell and using the S3
gauge theory doesn't ground state difference. It depends on how I Higgs it, right? So I can introduce by hand a Higgs field which just breaks me down to a charge 3 Higgs field, which breaks each one of these U1s down to a C. Yeah. I mean, it.
There are ways to get the U1 squared there, so there are ways.
There are ways to get the U1 squared, gets you into the degeneracy. How do you get the degeneracy out of
from the S3?
If this U1 squared, you said it's not a U1 squared, but U1 squared mod S3, then it would have. Yeah, that I can believe. But if I just have abelian gauge fields, abelian gauge fields are enough to ensure that my partons, the only gauge invariant partons, are. So the easiest example of this, right? Here's a model which you can write down, right? I take a U1 times U1 times U1 electromagnetism. I write down 3 partons. Forget about whether this comes out of SEC or not. 3 partons, I give them +1, -2, -2, +1, -1, -1, and the electromagnetism on kind of partons. The only gauge invariant combination you can write down that's electrically charged is Q1 times Q2 times Q3. There's nothing else you can do, and that theory will not have a ground state degeneracy. Yes, but so the logic to get to this is you can always rescale your U1s. You can get the charge assignment. That's not a naturally canonically normalized one. So if I rescale my charges to get that charge assignment, I get kinetic terms which are now mixed. But then I can always randomly change the kinetic terms. It will not change the topological structure of that model. So this is a deformed version of what I had before, where I changed coefficients of kinetic terms. And you may be right that I also dropped some S3 gauge fields. So it may not be right that I get exactly this by fixing the non-abelian SS3, but this is something that one can write down abelian models which have a unique constant. And the way basically Dirac quantization works is this MIT theorem is just a more careful phrasing of Dirac quantization. Instead of thinking about Euclidean four manifolds, you think about a process where on the T3, 2 cycles are already threaded by magnetic flux, and you study a process where you thread some extra magnetic flux through the last circle. And that should take you from ground state to ground state, and for that transition amplitude from ground state to be time reversal invariant, you would have to have theta equals 2 pi, but the one way out is if you have a ground state degeneracy, because in the ground state to ground state, amplitude doesn't take the same state into itself, but it may take one ground state into a different ground state, and then it doesn't have to be time reversal invariant, because it's not same state to same state. And the way this gets avoided is in this abelian theory, in theory A, the magnetic flux, the unit magnetic flux is not allowed. Without color magnetic flux. But you know why magnetic flux is quantized? Magnetic flux is basically quantized because my electric charges are quantized. So in a standard world where I have an electron of charge E, I have some basic unit of magnetic flux. If I now go to a world where my basic charge carriers are electrons, partons which have a charge E over 3, I suddenly find that the smallest magnetic flux that's allowed in my theory is 3 times what it is in our world. Then you might say that's ridiculous because I know in our world I can have unit magnetic flux. Something gotta happen if I put this unit magnetic flux through my topological insulator. What I'm telling you in that theory, it's true that you can't have unit magnetic flux if all you turn on is the Maxwell field, but you have this extra two U1s, you have this U1s squared statistical gauge fields. If I have a unit magnetic flux of the Maxwell field, this has to come with some color magnetic flux, by which I mean a flux of one of these extra U1s. And that outside of that material, that extra color magnetic flux is completely screened. Your gauge field gets confined, magnetic color magnetic fields get completely screened, it's completely irrelevant. But inside that material, the extra color magnetic flux ensures that if you look at the ground state to ground state transition amplitude, which now gotta be time reversal invariant all by itself, yes, it picks up some fractional term from the Maxwell phase alone, but that gets completely compensated by some extra phases it picks up from the presence of these extra color magnetic fluxes. And these color magnetic fluxes have to be there if you insist on turning on a unit Maxwell flux. And if you turn on 3 units of Maxwell flux, then you would get, with your zeta being pi over 3, you get all by itself the time reversing invariant amplitude. So in this case, it's these extra gapless degrees of freedom that ensure that you can have a unique ground state, even so you have a fractional zeta angle. Okay, so this was all I wanted to say about the fractional topological insulators. Now I want to tell you 4 interesting questions which we hopefully can address holographically about this, and then tell you what has been done in this respect and what needs to be done. So do we have maybe any questions about the fractional topological insulators, about their construction? Yes?
So for someone who really doesn't know anything, how come it's very difficult to say anything about QCD, but you can on this model say almost everything, or what are the tools?
So what I can say about QCD is the triangle diagrams, the anomaly, because they have one loop exam. So all I need to do my calculation is the triangle diagram. That's one of the few things I do know about QCD. The anomaly in QCD I know, and that's exactly all I need in order to calculate zeta.
General infrared properties in QCD are extremely different.
Yeah.
Now this problem is different, apparently, right?
For this one, so I didn't tell you how exactly I achieved to get QCD. I wanted to write QCD into a deconfined phase by adding extra matter. So people study this in the lattice to death. By now, there's a pretty clear idea when this happens. Now, if you add enough matter, QCD will become deconfined. What exactly enough is, people are still debating, but it's clear there's a window. There are lattice calculations which clearly demonstrate conformal behavior for some number of flavors. There's another theory which I'm going to use here, which is N equals 4 Zubriar Mills, where we have other independent evidence that it's not a conformal theory. We can use supersymmetry to make sure it's a conformal theory. But I don't really want to calculate much in this theory, right? The only thing I want about the theory, it's there. It ensures that my chart is neutral. The thing which I calculated for you is zeta being pi over n. And for that, all I need is a triangle diagram that I can calculate in any strongly coupled theory. The anomaly is completely protected.
You need to have deconfinement, and to get deconfinement, you have to add extra stuff in your field. And
but it's all electrically neutral, right? All the extra stuff
I will show in specific heat, maybe. It will show
in the specific heat, it surely will show. So the specific heat in those three models will be very different. The specific heat will be dominated in A and B by the massless stuff, not by the charge carriers. In phase C, the Higgs variation, everything is gapped, but in these two series, there's extra gapless stuff around. Of course, the gapless stuff dominates the heat capacity. The low energy heat capacity here will be all statistical gauges, not at all about the charge states.
And one more question. In A, B, and C, so these are classes of theory, right?
Yes.
So presumably are labeled by discrete parameters and continuous parameters. How many?
You can more or less write on any gauge group, any non-abelian gauge group, and there's a large range of matter content you could add. So there's a large class. You're just basically asking me, how can you write out a deconfined field theory? And there's like a lot of deconfined field theories you can write down in C plus one dimensions.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah. Take any deconfined field theory, you want to add one more matter particle, and it needs to have n dimensional representation in which I can add one more matter particle to which I declare it as one over n electric charge. And then, look, in our paper we have more complicated models where we don't just take the electron to break up into one kind of parton, but we can have it break up into different kinds of partons. This way we get, right now I've got a zeta which is pi over n. If you allow yourself to play those games and you have a very powerful formula to calculate zeta, you can easily get this to be pi times some odd integer over odd integer. Now it's easy to do that at this level. Now, once you allow yourself to just say, let my part, my electron part, and fractionalize into partons, there are a lot of things you can play at this level. what I did want to tell you is about interesting strong coupling problems in the system, things which you would like to understand, and then the things for which ADCC might be nice. Okay, what do I erase it over here? Erase it. Now you erase my ADC. Do you remember A is abelian free, B is not abelian strong interacting? So A and B are very similar in that they have gapless modes, but the main difference is A is free, B is interacting. And then model C was a completely gap one. It's probably the most realistic one, but the most boring for me to talk about. So let me ask a few strong coupling questions to which you might want to have answers. And then I give you my take on whether holography is going to have something to say about this or not. The first question you might ask yourself is, now how do I get this Lorentz defective theory, which we just derived as the right properties from interacting E minuses? And this is just a genuinely unsuited question for ADS-CFT. Right? What ADS-CFT is good for you is describing strongly coupled Lorentz defective theories. You're not going to ask ADS-CFT, provide for me a strongly interacting system of electrons that matches to something you see in the real world and see how it fractionalizes into any configurations. That's a dumb question to ask of holography. We know how to construct lattices by now in holography, but we don't know how to make these lattices do anything interesting like fractionalizing. Even if we would, these would be some highly supersymmetric lattices. They wouldn't be electron systems. And on top of this, condensed matter physics already beat us to this. There's some interesting work by Levin and others where they use the toy code and something. Now, some of the sort of toys condensed matter physics like to play with to at least give you some in-principle models where you get fractionalized charges in 3+1 dimensions. So I really think if this is probably the most interesting strong coupling question in this whole game, but ADS-CFT is, I think, dead in the water. Dead on arrival. No, you shouldn't ask use ADC to answer that question. Okay, it's probably, but at least it achieves, on this level, can I do it on a piece of paper? It answers that question already. And N+4, I think we have to work really, really hard to get something even looks like this. It may be amusing to do, but then you still wouldn't have the power that they had for the Unity Eye, where they can say, here's a material that is going to be fractional topological insulator, N+4 is never going to do for you. And maybe you can answer the in-principle questions with a lot of work. I would not encourage people. I'm not going to spend lots of sleepless nights in trying to cook up a holographic model of microscopic electrons. Here's a second strong coupling question you can ask. And that goes more like what you were asking about. If my in model B, Lorentz defective theory itself is strongly coupled, right? Because it's QCD basically, or some cousin of QCD that are broken into a deconfined phase. So you could ask yourself, is the analysis still valid? Now, do I see theta equals pi over n in that case? I told you it comes out of an anomaly, so it should be robust. So really nothing can go wrong, but it might be nice to ensure that if you actually study a strongly coupled model in which you can write down, can solve the strongly coupled Lorentz theory to check whether you do get out these transport properties associated with the fractal theta. And that is actually the one thing on my list that's already done, and that's what I wanted to show you in a second. So we do have a good theory in which we can solve this Lorentz strong coupling problem and confirm that everything works fine. So there's a third question which you might want to ask, which is the nature of the edge fluid, nature of the edge state. That's probably the most interesting one because it's this netherland of not easy to do but not done yet. So this is something that should be done, and I tell you in a second how one can do this. But right now I just wanted to explain the question for you. Right, we know in the standard topological insulator I have these massless electrons on the surface. At least in class C, where I have the Higgs model in the bulk, where my statistical gauge field is just on discrete gauge fields, I would still expect that I get this massless surface state. Just now, the C3 gate field doesn't have any massless modes, so the only massless modes on the surface should be the massless fermions themselves. But in all the interacting models, I end up having a surface which is massless fermions coupled to 2+1 dimensional gauge fields. That's the sort of problem that gives me interesting physics, right? There should be some interesting edge state there, if I put it at finite density, some interesting edge fluid, which is all about fermions strongly interacting with gauge fields. What is exactly the nature of this state?
Is it 3+1 gauge fields?
3+1 gauge fields interacting with the, no, 2+1 dimensional fermions. What is the nature of this edge fluid? Is this, does this give me some fermion liquid and non-fermion liquid? What exactly is this edge fluid? That's something in the holographic setting we can answer. We know what this edge fluid is. In particular, you should know this may be very interesting also from the holographic point of view, because by this construction, if I throw in extra matter which is scalars, they won't localize on the surface. So the surface modes are purely fermions. If I study that system at finite density, I'm going to study a holographic system where from the get-go I'm sure all the relevant dynamics is about fermions. I should really study so this edge liquid. It's going to be finite density of fermions coupled to the gauge field. And you know, we can ask ourselves in this holographic series what's the nature of this edge state. And that's something that's definitely within the range of the two holography. The last question I want to talk about is something about classification. Now, we know three topological insulators that have been beautifully classified also by people in the room. But the question of how do I even get started on classifying interacting topological insulators? I think people are still very puzzled about. And this is something the ADCC may be of some help. And I probably will be out of time, but I could tell you a few starting points that have already been done. But I have probably about 5 minutes left, which I wanted to tell you about, at least not this holographic description of how do you get a strongly coupled QCD-like theory that realizes a topological insulator on its surface. I mean, realizes one of the fractional topological insulators. Right. Let's talk about holographic TIs. So what do I need? What I need is non-abelian gauge theory. For example, with some SEN gauge group, plus extra adjoint matter. And I need this to have the beta function of some g being exactly zero, where one, if I take n large, in the end I want this one, the coupling of the zero to be much, much bigger than one. And I need extra matter in the fundamental representation. These are my patterns, which at least not massive. They have a finite mass. And need to include fermions. When I say need to include fermions, now I don't care whether there are some scalars there too. The scalars don't do anything interesting, but what I need is I need at least some massive fermion in the fundamental representation. Right? If you see it, when I first realized that that's a question I need to answer, I got really stunned because my topological insulators was my one attempt to finally move away from the 3D7 system. But this is like smack in your face what you need to study here is n equals super young mills. And then you need a D7 probe brain on top of this. It's kind of crying for you to study the system, right? So for the condensed matter physicists in the audience, I'm not going to explain exactly to you what this construction is. You heard a lot of talks about this before this workshop. Andy O'Bannon talked about this, and Johanna talked about this. So this is a system which realizes exactly that. Now, ADS-CFT itself gives the N+4 Young Mills a dual to strongly coupled conformal field theory, and then these probably 7 brains allow you to put in this extra matter, the patterns in our case.
So in the D7 case, you also need supersymmetry. N=4.
Yeah. So this will have 8 supercharges as opposed to 16, so preserves half of the supercharge. I don't need the supersymmetry. I can also write on programs which don't have any supersymmetry. But it doesn't hurt me, and it certainly makes calculations easy. Because in the end, the fermion localizes, and the mass term, the moment I turn on this kink for the mass, that breaks supersymmetry altogether, and that will make the fermions behave very differently from the scalars. The fermions localize on the interface, and the scalars don't.
And in those cases, one can still make statements?
Yeah, so what I need, so if I draw this picture, you know, how this looks like. So here's my ADS space, or the one version of ADS. It has some boundary up here. It has a horizon down here. I'm at zero temperature, so no black hole. This is UV IR. Everything falls down. It's one reason to draw ADS like this. And then what this D7 brain looks like, it's a massive, corresponds to a massive field. So it only covers the UV part of the space. And what exactly it's doing, there's some internal sphere. Again, if you haven't seen this right now, no, this will not explain anything to you. But the way this 7 brain can end is because it slips off the internal sphere. It starts out on the equator up top, and it slips to zero size down here. It's the 7 brain is some point in the x8. The D3 brain is on 0, 1, 2, 3. It spans three directions. D7 shares those and has 4, 5, 6, 7. I have 7 spatial dimensions. It's a point in 8 and 9. So I characterize this by some angle theta. I have a two-dimensional space, I have some angle theta, but then I also have an angle phi, which is, you know, x8 goes like cosine phi and x9 for the sine phi. So you see I have a complex parameter, it's my complex mass. The position of the 7 brain, this 8-9 space, is the complex mass. Saying I want to have time reversal invariance tells me I should either have phi to 0 or phi plus pi. What I need to do is on this side I want to have phi to 0. On this side, I want to have phi plus pi. What it exactly tells me is that what my mass parameter has this non-trivial profile, it crosses zero in the middle. It goes to a constant here, it goes to a constant there. So the equation of motion at gamma in the 7 brain is that it basically wants to minimize its world volume. So what you have to find, this is a two-dimensional PDE, you need to find the embedding of the 7 brain as a function of radius and as a function of the one spatial direction of the field theory. Two-dimensional partial differential equation is just the equation of motion that follows from the fact that the 7 brain wants to minimize its world volume area. Now, PDEs aren't that scary these days anymore. And here's a picture I just wanted to show you that, you know, more or less just saying we did it. So, it's the details depend on the mass profile is up to you, right? All you want is a mass profile interpolates from constant to constant, and you don't really care how it interpolates from constant to constant. So out here, this is the boundary of my ADS space. Here, this is basically the mass profile you put in something. It's almost a step function, something very steep, and you get a nice, smooth embedding of this D7 brain. That's a holographic dual to exactly the setup which I described to you before. But can you learn from this? In principle, the full dynamical properties of the system are encoded in the 7 brain. You can ask any question you want. You can calculate all correlation functions in the system. You can calculate the heat capacity in the system, since somebody asked me. None of this has been done, but it's all zero temperature. But this is a proof of principle. You can get the 7 brain embedding. So now that you looked at it, and, you know, you realize that you can solve two-dimensional partial differential equations. Let me move this away again, since there's not your...
What kind of differential equation does one get?
No, something horribly nonlinear, but it's some non.
Bali, elliptic. What is it?
It's a
differential equation.
Yeah, it's some second order differential equation. It's something you can solve by.
It's elliptic.
It's elliptic, good. Since it's a minimal area problem, so what you can do is you can basically do some Euclidean time evolution. That's why it's so easy to solve. It's like a soap bubble problem. You have the 7 brain, it wants to minimize its area, you have boundary conditions. You put some random trial initial area for the 7 brain. You let it evolve in Euclidean time towards smaller area, and right away finds a minimum of its area, which solves the equation of motion. So it's really fairly straightforward to get this.
Is there a picture of the dynamics that you're solving by doing that? Is the RG evolution of the mass of the
plate? Yeah, I mean you're studying the full dynamics of the system. Yes, you would still have the standard IRUV dictionary, I would think that it, as you said, it somehow encodes RG flow, but not exactly. I don't know how to match one to one, but you clearly can get, you know, study fluctuations around the profile, which I showed you, would give you correlation functions in theory. The one thing which we did calculate, since I advertised that we learned something from this, other than, no, I didn't just want to demonstrate to you that we can solve second order differential equations, that we can minimize errors, but the claim is that we learned something. And what we did learn is that while details depend exactly on M on what mass profile you choose. Now we solved this for one particular one. Just some random choice depend on M of X. One thing that comes out universal is that we get theta equals to pi over M as advertised. And that one comes out because this is, the theta term comes out of one, in addition to minimizing its world volume, this December has in its world volume best minimum term. And then one that's relevant here is some f wedge c4. Where if I integrate this by parts, it ends up being on the interface some a wedge f wedge, some five-fold field strength. This picks up n units of flux from the internal sphere. And then you end up getting, you know, on the interface exactly the John Simons term which you should get from a theta that corresponds to pi over n. That's, in the end, I think that, you know, it was nice that it worked out. There are some pi's and 2's which you need to check, because these are all things that are exactly known in string theory. If you plug in all the pi's and all the n's, you get exactly the theta equals pi over n out like it should be. But in the end, that was guaranteed, because the Vestimina term on the deep range side, that's what encodes the anomaly of the field theory. I told you it's an anomaly calculation that gave me pi over n to begin with. So as long as string theory works, as long as this Vestimina term did its job and encoded the anomaly, it got to give me this pi over n, and it did.
Is the brain system describing the time reversal broken?
Okay, now you're asking me an interesting question. So when I say this gives me exactly the theta with pi over n, what the theta really is, it's a change in phi divided by n. Where phi was this angle in this x89 plane. So if I draw some sort of embedding space, here's my V3 brain. Here's, say, the x8 direction. And I have this V3 brain that's really truly time reversal invariant always. I draw a picture like this. Then phi is equal to 0 here, and phi discontinues and jumps to pi. I'm not really sure how to calculate this. In order to get this answer, what you should do in your head, you deform this a little bit in the x9 plane to move around here. So to even make sense of the theta parameter in a well-controlled calculation, you want to, in your head, do a tiny deformation where you know infinitesimally bend this guy out and move it around in the 3 brain. That's exactly the same. This non-energy effective theory is only valid if I have at least some small time worth of bracket deformation. Okay, so finite density. Let me just close with kind of telling you how to do the next two. This is what we've done, and this was in 3+1 was with Jensen and Hoyos, and then we did it also in 2+1 and 1+1. We didn't solve PDEs anymore, but we told you what systems you're describing. You're describing class D and D3 topological insulators. And 2+1 and 1+1 dimension, that was this Kakianagi and Manchieko. Is this how you pronounce it? Joseph. And this has been done. I think that was a good starting point in the sense it answered some strong coupling question on my list. Of course, this was the most interesting one. Again, I think this one was guaranteed to work, but it gives me the groundwork for answering questions 3 and 4. Now, everybody who's ever done a holographic calculation knows exactly what to do to answer part 3. What I need to do is I need to redo this exercise with turning on AT as a function of X and R. So I need to solve the PDE with 2 fields as opposed to 1 field. So that's clearly something that can be done, and it should tell you something about the nature of this edge fluid. And then about the classification, Takayanagi and Wu showed that you can reproduce the classification of the free theory by classifying. You start with a single U1 gauge, so you're living on a color brain. You add one of those probe brains, a single one of those, and ask yourself, what are the allowed probe brains I can add in flat space? And that reproduces the classification of the non-interacting series. You could ask yourself, is there something like a K-series classification that tells me what is the most general probe you could throw into some ADS spacetime? Maybe this is a good starting point, because it's so easy in ADC to include interactions. Maybe we can make some partial progress on this classification problem. This wouldn't be like the most general holographic and most general topological insulator you can write down this interaction. But at least in this class of no matter interacting with strongly coupled non-abelian gate fields, one should hope that one could get some handle on seeing whether there's something interesting new that happens using, I don't think anybody has systematically classified D-brains not in flat space. Use K-series classifies D-brains in ADS spaces. It seems to be something that has been studied on case-by-case spaces. There's an interesting paper by Sakai and Sugimoto where they really studied D-brains in the Sakai-Sugimoto model and classified those. But doing the most general thing, just studying what do you get out of Witten's K-series description of deep brains when you apply it to these strongly curved backgrounds, or the curved backgrounds that you get out of the ADC free correspondence, I think this may be a good starting point to say something interesting about this. This one will work if one just does it. This one may or may not work. I can't tell you. And on this note, I'll stop.
Any other question?
In the third case, you can also study things when it's doped in the boundary, in the sense that it has finite density, not just.
Yes, I can study this at finite density. Like I said, you want global symmetry under which only this matter is charged, under which all these extra junk is neutral. That's just like my electric charge before. So I, you know, in my language before, I only wanted the charge carriers to be this guy, these are the particles, and this is all this extra phonon junk that just there to make my theory consistent that shouldn't participate in the
dynamics. But my question is that, will it be very different in the kind of attempt we'll have made for describing non-Fermi liquid, or is it a very different way of looking at?
Well, it has this spatial dependence, right? So in the standard non-Fermi liquid, if you only listen to a top-down approach, you typically end up systems which have fermions and other stuff. So you don't quite know what you turn on the density. Here, similar, right? You turn, in this system, if you turn on, like this 3D7 system itself at finite density, you turn at finite density for scalars and fermions, you get all these weird things you get, you know, a heat capacity goes like T6, but you get a zero sound, which looks like the one of the Fermi liquid. You've been here for the whole talk, right? You have probably talked about this, but it's an extremely puzzling system if you turn on finite density for it all by itself. But the hope is that maybe even gets easier. So now you take this D7 grain instead of turning on a density for the system and it has just a finite mass, it's the same everywhere. The first thing you do is you take the mass and give it a kick. Now turn on finite density. Now you should isolate there's this edge fluid. So you have to bite just whatever it did before, and it has T6 capacity and does all this crazy stuff. But then if I do it massive, right, it won't contribute to the low energy dynamics at all. There's this, the only light mode in the system should be this fermion, not light on the surface. You know it's only the fermions. If I turn on finite density, should be completely determined by the fermions. It's the same principle you turn on an AT in the bulk, you have electric flux that goes outward, but you do this in the presence of this spatial kink profile for the brain. So it's the same techniques, but it's more complicated. Instead of solving AT, the function of R, only the holographic direction, you have to solve AT, the function of R and X. So everything depends on this one spatial direction across the geometry. You go from ODEs to PDEs. Yeah.
I'm really an ignorant, so I need an ignorant answer. that would satisfy an ignorant. So for someone who is in, so understand on the left hand side I have this complicated, strongly interacting system, and on the right hand side I have this ADF CFT procedure. So I want to understand in what sense is this computation much simpler. And what did I have? What was the entry ticket price?
It's simple in the sense that I don't, as you pointed out to me before, I don't know how to even get going on this, right? It's only a couple of young Mills at finite density, you have zero techniques to do, right? It's only a couple of young Mills typically say lattice, but the moment you have finite density, or actually already the moment you say n-transposed young Mills, you have a sign problem, you don't know how to put it in a computer. Realistically, you can't do Monte Carlo weighting because the action is complex.
And these problems are absent in this case?
In the geometric description, it's just classical geometry. You minimize, you have minimal area action. Now, ADCFT solves that problem. The strongly coupled theories in a complete analytic control. The price you have to pay is
that if you have quantum theory anymore.
That's right. It's the n equals 4 theorem takes a strongly coupled large n gauge theory and says it's due to a classical theory of gravity. In this case, it's progress classical theory of gravity plus a minimal area action for this problem. Now, that's the power of ADCFT. The price you have to pay, since you asked me about the price to pay. When I talked about, I didn't talk much, but if you ever wanted to talk about real world applications, so how could this material possibly arise? Maybe it's not too adventurous to say this, but you can get such a system with some discrete C3 gauge fields. Maybe you can even imagine like some abelian gauge fields. Maybe if you're really pushing, you can imagine some S3 gauge fields. If you find any abelian material, the chance that it's going to be any good for similar mills is going to be So the price you have to pay is out of this whole class of strongly coupled non-abelian gauge fields. You could have chosen, you had to choose the one that is to some extent the most exotic, but it allows you to use this very powerful tool
of quantum.
It's also large n, yeah. So we say that pi over n, that n, for me to be able to solve it, then n actually has to be a large integer, otherwise I can't use it. That's what makes it classical.
So when I look at this classical gravity, of all these, I mean, there is a huge particle content in this super
theory,
right? So at the end, do I focus on a single object, like, I don't know, a gravitational field that I'm computing? What do I compute some orbit?
Now we have to redo probably the whole notion, but yeah, there's a dictionary that tells you all the gauge, what ADCFT calculates for you is correlation function of gauge invariant operators. So So the graviton would be due to the stress energy tensor, the gauge field in the bulk is due to the current. So out of all the objects you know, all the gauge and operators in your theory, you can calculate their 1-point functions, which is enough to get, say, the thermodynamics out and asking what is the heat capacity, what is the conductivity for this. All you need is 1-point functions. You can calculate correlation functions, you can calculate any 2-point function. All those things you can calculate just by studying fluctuations on the gravity side. That's the ADS-DFT dictionary tension. This theory can be solved using classical gravity, but it's a very special theory. For my first lecture, I said holography provides us with solid toy models of strong coupling dynamics. I think that's the most concise summary of why, you know, there's some hope in using ADS-DFT for condensed matter physics, because, you know, in these toy models, you can really answer all these questions. They're toy models, you know, and this force dynamics, it's not going to be the right description for any solid anytime soon. It can be solved. It's a qualitative question you could ask yourself. Now, what is this nature of a strongly coupled edge liquid? You could at least, in one example, answer this question exactly.
Do you expect a correction to this theta term, say, in 1 over n squared or anything like that?
No,
or is it stable?
This calculation, the holographic calculation, was only reliable in large n. But the anomaly calculation is valid at all ends. This was a triangle diagram. The triangle diagram is one loop example. Going from integrating out this fermion, getting the Sayer term, that's really just the ABJ anomaly. ABJ is not anomaly Berkeley.
On general grounds of pessimism, I'd expect that your local fermions are interacting with the Sinus 4 theory will somehow kill themselves and they'll pair or something.
But then, by time reversal inversion, they're not allowed to do that.
They can form a system.
So I told you I haven't studied the finite density yet, so that would be telling the true ground state of the system would be something.
The rank can get
a chiral condensate.
Yes,
it would be ground. So you would be saying there's some that the T invariant time version rank gets spontaneously broken, that could cost up. And then you've now the question is, yeah, maybe that's what one should expect. That's certainly something one could answer. So you would still have answered the question of what's the nature of the edge fluid, and you'd be saying the nature of the edge fluid is in the spontaneous space time. It would be a more disappointing answer than saying it's interesting non fermion. But at least you're studying a system where only the fermions carry the dynamics. So if it's a superconductor, you know who's condensing is the Cooper pair of these edge fermions. I'm off the hook.